This is Gene McMillan interviewing Mr. Charles Cook at his home, Pondfield, 181 Interlaken Road, Lakeville, Connecticut. He is going to speak about the Institute of World Affairs. The date is Monday, August 15, 2011. Mr. Cook, what is your full name?
Charles D. for David Cook. No E.
And your birth date and place?
Born in Saginaw, Michigan, April 5th, 1924, the only child of Charles Christian Cook and Grace Robbins Cook.
Now, would you give me some of your personal background, please?
Well, as you know, I was born in the state of Michigan, the great state of Michigan, as they say, and went through public high school and entered the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor in my first year after high school, which was 1942. I then was enrolled in the Army ROTC at the University of Michigan. And then I was drafted into the service and in the process ended up being sent into the Navy because their quota was for the day to enroll people into the Navy hadn't been filled. And so my original involvement with the U.S. Army came to an end, and I joined the Navy to see the world. I can cut short the next few years. I went to Great Lakes Naval Training Station in north of Chicago, in Waukegan, Illinois. And from there, I was, after finishing boot camp, was assigned into their college officers training program in the Navy called the V-12 program. And lo and behold, I ended up back in Ann Arbor where I had been the academic year before. So this was the start of September, October of 43. And I went through number of semesters that the Navy required there, and then was sent to what you might call the finishing school for officers, which was midshipman's training at, in this case, Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. That was a four-month training program, after which one was, if you survive, was given the commission as an ensign in the U.S. Naval Reserve. At the last few weeks before we were to depart and be assigned to some new part of the Navy, I discovered that there was a program for Oriental language training, and in particular Russian, that the Navy offered. And I knew that the training took place primarily in on the East Coast and in New York City. So the footnote there is that my future wife was a student at Juilliard, and to get to New York would have accomplished being close to her as well as achieving my objective of getting into the Russian language program. However, this was the Navy, and as I walked in the office of the Lieutenant Commander Hindmarsh, H-I-N-D-M-A-R-S-H, the one who recruited people for the Oriental Language Program, he looked up and said, "So you want to study Japanese?" And the obvious answer was, "Yes, sir," since one didn't contradict your superior officers. And that meant that I'd be sent to their main Japanese language training program in Boulder, Colorado, the University of Colorado, which also had classes in Chinese, Malayan, and Russian. But I was not to go to the Russian, I was to go to the Japanese. For comparison's sake, the Russian program was a six-month program. The Malayan was 4 to 6 months, something like that. The Japanese program was 14 months, and the Chinese program was 16 months. So I could look forward to 14 months of training in reading and writing and speaking Japanese.
But what a wonderful experience.
Well, it turned out to be, of course, a life-changing experience in many respects. It made me much more aware of the Western interests of the United States. I say Western because it's Western from Michigan or from the East Coast. But Asia and the Asian War, in many respects, wasn't as much in the minds of people here on the East Coast as the European War was. But the European War was winding down, and we still had to defeat the Japanese. I continued in that program, which involved one transfer of location to Stillwater, Oklahoma. A decision had been made to concentrate all Japanese training, which came from various other places, as well as Boulder, into one big group at the Oklahoma A&M, Stillwater, Oklahoma. And this was in the summer of 45, and it was hot. And I remember taking a shower, stepping out of the shower, and immediately being drenched in perspiration. It wasn't too long thereafter that the first atom bomb was dropped, and then the second, and today is the anniversary of all of that, today being August 15th. Everyone went into Tulsa, which is the nearest city of any consequence, and we celebrated in the city. Oklahoma then, maybe still is, was a dry state. That means they did not have allow alcohol to be sold in stores or in bars. Naturally, there are violations of such restrictions. The well-known one was if you wanted a bottle of something, you got a hold of a taxi driver and he would find one for you.
Clever.
And so most of my fellow students had bottles of something or other stashed in their rooms. And when we came back after celebrating in Tulsa, we found that the university authorities had gone in and cleaned out every single room of its alcoholic content. Big question for all of us was, what happens now? The war is over. There's still a mess to clean up in the Far East. Are they going to need Japanese language officers? And they gave us three alternatives. One was to complete our program, the remaining number of months that were required for the minimum of graduation, or join something called the Foreign Service of the United States. And thirdly, was to take your chances and be assigned to the fleet somewhere, presumably in the Pacific. I made the calculation, as did a lot of my fellow students, that once we had gone to the fleet, so to speak, we would begin to accumulate the number of points that was necessary to be eligible for being mustered out of the service. I have no idea what those numbers were anymore, but it seemed that I would reach that within a reasonable period of time, and I could go back to being a civilian and complete my education. So I was sent off to California, where we waited around for a while and discovered that General MacArthur, who was in charge of all of the armed forces of the United States in the Japan and in the area of Japan, did not want any more naval personnel sent in. And so that meant our orders had to be rewritten, because we were destined to be flown into Japan and work as what were called civil censors. In other words, censoring the civilian mail, which we would be able to do because we would know how to read their letters and so on. Whether I ever felt that I was up to that or not, I'm not sure. But in any event, that was not in our future because of General MacArthur's superior order. And we all in my group ended up being sent to Pearl Harbor for further dispersal throughout the naval establishments in the Pacific. And my lot was to be assigned to the island of Saipan in the Marianas. And we were flown in what are called PBYs, the flying boats that landed on the water and not in the, in the, on land. And we flew from Honolulu, Pearl Harbor, to Johnson Island, refueled, and flew on to Kwajalein, which is in the Marshall Islands, I believe. And from there, we were, my group was scattered around. One of my buddies went to Guam, another went to Tinian, and I flew on to Saipan.
Is this where you got associated with the World Affairs Institute?
No, it simply interested, it turned my interest into international affairs. And this perhaps is more than you want to have recorded as far as my background is concerned. You have to fast forward to after the war to the fact that I came back once we were all released. We returned to our wherever educational institution we wanted to, and I went back to Ann Arbor and in one semester completed all the requirements I needed for my bachelor's degree and promptly applied for law schools and ended up being able to get into Columbia Law School in New York City in the middle of the year because Columbia had wisely revised its curriculum so that people could go 3 semesters a year instead of 2 with a summer off. And while I was in the law school studying, I was beginning to wonder whether I really wanted to be a lawyer. And I had one of my classmates sitting near me in the library reading from something called World Union. And it was a magazine, and I asked him about it. This individual was Sterling Black, who was the son of Justice Hugo Black of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he was a good friend of mine at that point. And once went down to Washington with him. In any event, what he was reading was a publication of something called the Institute of World Affairs. And so I asked him more about it, and he said it's an organization which has a summer program up in Connecticut, and they raise money to finance it through wealthy donors in New York City and in Palm Beach. He asked if I wanted to be introduced to them, so I said sure.
And what year was this?
This was 40. The spring of 48. And I met the lady who was in charge of the Institute, Mrs. Hatton, Maud Minor Hatton, and she granted me a scholarship to attend her Institute of World Affairs that summer up in Twin Lakes, Connecticut.
Can you
That was my original introduction to.
Can you tell me when the Institute of World Affairs started and where it started?
Yes, the Institute was begun in the early 30s, or middle 30s, I guess. Mrs. Hatton and her husband were just married in later stage in life, and decided to take their honeymoon in Geneva, Switzerland. And when they arrived, this was at the time when the League of Nations was very active, and the United States was not a member of the League of Nations, had decided against such foreign entanglements. And so those who felt that the world was a unit thought that the United States should be involved in all of this and at least know about it. And so she persuaded her husband to set up an institute in Geneva that would invite college-level students from the United States and from other countries to participate in living in one big sort of apartment house and taking their meals together and studying together, that the outcome would be that people would get to know that people from other countries were what they were like, and that they were anxious to be friendly with each other. So the institute flourished for several years on that basis, with drawing talent for speakers from the League of Nations and from institutions that favored this point of view, and sent their professors to Geneva to be a party to all of it. And so many people who later turned through World War II and afterwards into prominent personalities in their own countries could trace their origins in this interest back to the Institute of World Affairs. It was called something else at that time, and the name that it was known by was similar to the name of an organization that was communist or communist front organization. And so as the war made it impossible to bring students to Geneva, And a decision was taken to move the institute to Connecticut. They changed the name to Institute of World Affairs to avoid any confusion with this Communist Front organization that had turned up.
What connection did Mrs. Haddon have with this area to bring the institute to Salisbury area?
Mrs. Haddon owned a substantial amount of property around the one of the Twin Lakes, and in addition, she was very much involved with an organization that was designed to look after what I would call wayward girls. It had a substantial building, a dormitory, a kitchen and dining room and so on. And it had, I guess, pretty well ended its existence and was sitting there with availability, so the institute took it over, and made it into the girls' dorm for the institute. The men's dorm was back down the road a bit. We had to walk for our meals to the to this other place. There were a couple of wonderful old farmhouses on the property, and later these were expanded, and we had our academic work all took place in this one area where Mrs. Haddon had her house. She did have another place on another part of the lake. She was very much devoted to this area and to her creation, and she did then also spend her winters in Palm Beach and to some extent in New York City.
How many students would be at the institution in Connecticut during the summer?
At time of my being there as a student in 1948, there must have been about 18 to 20 students, half of which more or less were Americans. And then we had people from other countries, from South America, from Canada, from Asia, and from Europe, and the Middle East.
And what would the seminar comprise? Was it strictly lecture, or?
Well, we had a academic director who would start off the morning. Mind you, these are relatively young college age students, and he would take the New York Times or Washington Post and go over the main stories of interest in the area of international affairs, and analyze the story, show people how to read a newspaper article, and consequently how the article had been constructed in the first place. And then he had prepared a number of subjects for the for the several weeks of the summer, which we were divided up into groups. Each subject was to be explored by one of the groups, and so a good deal of the afternoon time was taken up with the students doing research to the extent they had access to written materials there at the Institute. He had, I think, tried to limit the areas that we were being assigned to look into to that which we had source material to explore. And he would work with each individual group for a certain amount of time during the day, and he would oftentimes have a lecture on a particular subject. But we also were fortunate that Mrs. Haddon, with her connections, was able to entice leading educators from Harvard and Yale to come in and talk with the students as well. And and even from people who were connected with the United Nations. One in particular was Dr. Ralph Bunch, who had just recently been given the Nobel Peace Prize, and he was able to come up with his son and with his wife and son and spend a little time with the students. And in particular, I remember that he and his boy, Ralph Jr., went out in an aluminum canoe that had at the front and rear, the fore and aft ends of the canoe had air contained in it so that it wouldn't sink. And unfortunately, they turned over while they were out on the Twin Lakes, and they had to push the canoe back to shore.
What an introduction to Connecticut.
Yes.
How many summers did you attend?
Well, I attended as a student the summer of 48. The summer of 49, Mrs. Haddon had decided to temporarily conduct the seminar in Geneva and thereby attract people back who had gone to it before. And so for the summer, it was an alumni seminar in effect. So for the summer of 49, my wife and I took off for Geneva by going on a student ship that the Holland America Lines ran of old boats that had been used in the the Dutch hostilities in Southeast Asia, and were no longer needed, and these were hardly luxury ships. They had accommodations for
the students were bunked three deep, one just underneath the ceiling, one in the middle, one in the bottom, they weren't hammocks, but they were pretty close to it, and it was.
It was a little primitive.
Quite an experience, but we were young and what the heck, it was interesting.